Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by Fraser Nelson and James Forsyth. So over the weekend, Chancellor Philip Hammond warned that a no-deal Brexit would leave the UK at the mercy of the French. So how much credence should we give this claim? And when did Philip Hammond become the latest anti-no-deal Brexit freedom fighter? Fraser, what do you think?
Well, we've always known that Philip Hammond is one of the most active opponents of Brexit. As Chancellor, he was perhaps chief saboteur in refusing to come up with plans for a no-deal Brexit. That was his job. He refused to do it, knowing that that would leave the Prime Minister with no options. And so the sort of impasse we're in, it has probably more to do with his acts of subterfuge than anybody else's. He is being as good as his word outside government. Well, he's not quite outside government now, but he will be as soon as there's a new prime minister. So he wants to try to make out that no deal would be a disaster and illustrate the many ways in which he thinks it would be a disaster. Now, I'm not quite persuaded by what he says. Technically, he's correct to say that Emmanuel Macron, if he wants to, could make it quite difficult for Britain by, in using Hammond's words, dial up or dial down the queues at Calais. In other words, decide to have one in 100 vehicles checked or every second vehicle checked. Now, the WTO rules allow both of them. So yes, he could be vexatious. But would he really want to put Northern France through their economic misery just to be vindictive, just to get one over on the English? Now, we all know that Macron sees this from a very political point of view. When he looks at Boris Johnson, he sees basically Marine Le Pen in trousers. He knows that he is chased in France with people who think that France should be out of the EU as well. I mean, sure, the Le Penites don't say it quite as loudly as they used to, but that's still their policy. So it suits Macron politically to show that leaving the EU is a disaster. But would he be willing to use his own voters, his own countrymen, as sort of economic sacrifices to make that point? I don't think even Macron would go through with that, so I'm not inclined to take Philip Hammond's warnings at face value.
James, what does this mean for Boris Johnson premiership once Philip Hammond goes back to the backbenches? Is he going to make things very, very difficult?
I think, as so often with Brexit, people are becoming radicalised very quickly, and Philip Hammond appears to be becoming radicalised. I mean, it is worth remembering that he hasn't ruled out voting against the government in a confidence vote, which is quite remarkable. The Times carries a very intriguing report this morning of an address Hammond made to Treasury staff, where he essentially said, don't change your advice on no-deal Brexit, it will still be a disaster. Pointed out the government's majority was only three or four, and that he was planning to kind of be in Parliament where the action was. You know, there's an obvious implication there as to what he is going to do.
He probably like resigned before he's sacked or something like that.
Yeah, I think the other thing which is interesting is he also admits that it was a conscious policy of the Treasury not to encourage firms to prepare for a no-deal Brexit in case that would have caused economic damage. If you don't prepare the private sector for this, if you don't tell firms you've got to go and get a customs agent, you've got to be ready to deal with these new checks, the country's not going to be able to deal with no-deal Brexit. I mean, that's a remarkable admission from Philip Hammond of something that his critics have been saying for months and years, that he deliberately was not prepared to see firms prepare for this. And the irony is, that decision not to get British firms to prepare for it has A, made no deal more likely, and B, has meant that it will be more disruptive than it otherwise needed to be if it happened. Now, in his warning about the French, this is the essential point about no deal, which is so much of this depends on what the attitude is on both sides. How much have things totally and utterly broken down when it comes to no deal? Because, you know, yes, you could say that President Macron could decide to dial up the pressure. But, you know, as one cabinet minister once put it to me, you know, in that circumstance, the UK could kind of take Ireland hostage. You know, a huge amount of Ireland's trade with the EU uses the UK as a land bridge, right? And, you know, you could see a policy, you know, where you send Irish trucks to the back of a queue at Dover. You know, the French could say, well, let them through to the front of a queue instead of all the British trucks. You could turn around and say, well, they'll go, you know, I mean, all this stuff. And the question is, and this is one of the great questions about no deal to which no one can know the answer, is does it turn into the most acrimonious kind of divorce ever, where people are prepared to hurt themselves if it hurts the other side more, or is it done with some some sense that everyone's going to have to carry on being neighbours afterwards, and there are sensible mitigations put in place to keep these ports roughly flowing, etc., etc., etc. My personal view is that Macron will want there to be enough chaos visible to make all French voters think that the Brexit project has failed. But I also think that he would be wary about drawing a kind of Gilets Jaunes-style reaction as people in northern France say, hang on a second, what are you doing? This is really hurting us economically. Because, again, one of the big questions about EU solidarity is, do you see ports in Belgium and Holland trying to turn around to British businesses and saying, well, look, if you're having trouble at Calais, you can come here. Yeah. Because, again, within EU law, there is a whole variety of positions you could take on the checks and how quickly you move things through. It sounds to me from the preparations like the port of Calais is, unless it is politically countermanded, which is obviously a possibility, the port of Calais is trying to keep things fairly sensible, to keep things moving, and that basically the deal it appears to have done with the ferry companies is that people who don't have the right paperwork will be turned back in Dover, so they won't gum things up in Calais. That obviously could cause problems at the Dover end of things, and that brings you back to the Philip Hammond point, which is, you would be less worried that these trucks would turn up at Dover without the right paperwork if the UK government had been encouraging the private sector to prepare for the likelihood of no deal.
It's probably worth saying as well that if you listen to what they're saying in Calais, they're saying that they will simply refuse to obey Macron if he decides. Well,
and that's the mayor of Calais himself.
This is Jean-Marc Puissasseau, who's the president and chief exec of the Port Boulogne-Calais. He's been telling us that, in his words,
I would be wary of this. The French president has more power than almost any other, you know, Western head of state. I mean, if Macron wants these checks, I mean,
they're saying he'd have to basically send in the National Guard to enforce these checks because they would do it themselves. Jean-Marc Puissot is saying that the trucks will be passing as they are doing today in a no-deal Brexit. There will not be any delay. He thinks it would be poisonous to his business model. He'd lose business en masse to Rotterdam and other places. Now, you're right, James. Maybe Macron will send in the troops too. But what a sight. It will be Gilets Jaunes on a factor of 10. And do we really think he'd be willing to do that? Now, of course, the answer is that the French president is probably more likely to take action against the French than any other president of any other country is likely to take action of their own people. This is, in France, the politics is decided on the streets in a way that it tends to be more than other countries. So I wouldn't rule anything out. But he would have a big fight in his hands if, for his own political reasons, he wants to basically disable the economic potential of the north of France and the port authorities.
Okay, just moving back to London politics, one person that they've lost on the Gawker squad against no deal is Amber Rudd, as we talked about last week. James, how has that gone down with her former compatriots in the anti-no deal camp?
I think they are disappointed because, and I think one of the reasons they are disappointed is because she had an organisational ability and an emotional intelligence that a lot of other people in the Gawker squad don't have. I think they also fear that she is a preview of what is to come from lots of people. Ultimately, the question for all these people is, are they prepared to actually bring the government down in a no confidence vote? Because if they're not, their powers and ability to block a no deal Brexit are limited. And I think it is a very odd thing if you think about the things that Philip Hammond worries about. Surely a Corbyn and McDonnell government bring more of those about than a no-deal Brexit does. If you're worried about Britain's global economic reputation, you're worried about the public finances, I find it very hard to see how in anything other than the shortest of short terms, you could not think that a McDonnell-Corbyn government would be more damaging than even a fairly disruptive no-deal Brexit. I also think that, you know, there is slightly more, maybe slightly more wiggle room in terms of timings on this Brexit than we thought. I thought it was a very telling moment in the Andrew Neil interview with Boris Johnson, when Boris Johnson said, was asked about October 31st and whether he would extend by a day or two, you know, or a week or two, if that was what was needed to get a deal through. And he said, there's no point in admitting this is a phony deadline now. That use of the word now, I thought, was very telling, because that did suggest that if nearer the time, a tiny bit more time was needed, then he might be prepared to take it.
Europeans will never suspect a thing, eh?
My sense is that Boris Johnson's view, that the real test is this. I don't think the deal needs to be into UK law by October 31st. I think the deal needs to have been agreed with the EU and voted for in principle by Parliament by October 31st. I think if it is merely a stage of after October the 31st, it going through its committee stage and it's all that stuff.
But even that is, you know, even that is very hard to get, isn't it?
Oh, that is hard to get. And but there is a kind of question here, right, which is ultimately, are the you see reports today that the EU are kind of deeply depressed by Steve Barclay going to Brussels to say that the Theresa May deal is dead, etc., etc., etc. But you can't get around the fact that this deal has been rejected three times by Parliament, and without a significant change, it isn't going to pass Parliament. So if the EU genuinely don't want no deal, they are going to have to move. And that is the question, you know. Are they prepared to move? You know, if you look at Varadkar's kind of goading of the UK over the weekend, you know, talking about how Britain hasn't going to come, is going to go into economic decline and it hasn't come to terms with us and all that stuff, you know, that would suggest that they are getting ready to go for no deal. Because fundamentally, them not moving is them choosing no deal. There's absolutely no doubt about that fact. And so the kind of question is, are they prepared to come up with some kind of change or not to see if something can happen? And that ball is in their court, because you can't get around the fact that politically this deal has been brought to Parliament three times and rejected three times, and it isn't going to get through Parliament without some kind of change. Now, I think the clever thing to do is to ask for a change that is possible, but you could see, you know, where the UK needs to compromise is, you know, you can't just ask for the backstop to be ripped up in its entirety. You need to ask for something that comes within the realms of something that the Irish could sell at home and something that the EU kind of more broadly could accept. But there is a big choice here for the EU about whether it is prepared to move to try and avert no deal, or whether it wants to go down a no-deal path.
But actually, interestingly, there are signs in Ireland of the mood turning against Coveney and Varadkar over this. I mean, sure, they might politically think it's they've got no option but to stand up to the nefarious Brits and tell them that they would rather no-deal Brexit than more compromise with the Brits. But there was a fascinating remark from Pat Leahy, who's the political editor of the Irish Times, and it's worth quoting here. He's saying, "The government has relished wearing the green jersey, standing up to the British on Brexit with help of the EU, but isn't the possibility of border checks in a few years better than the certainty of checks on October the 31st. Basically, that is the making the case for a time-limited backstop. So I think that the more the Irish peer over this ledge, it will be quite clear that yes, they could go through with this. Yes, they would survive. Yes, there would be lots of pain. But why take this pain for the price of intransigence? For, as Pat Leahy puts it, standing up in that green Irish jersey and banging the nationalist drum.
And not to make this podcast sound like a promotion for the Irish Times, there was also a very interesting letter to the Irish Times from Geoffrey Donaldson, the DUP's chief whip at Westminster, last week, when he was pointing out that Brexit meant that there needed to be more North-South cooperation, not less, and that agriculture and plant health and animal health are devolved matters. What that is essentially code for is, if you give Stormont the power over the backstop, essentially, how to choose, work out the alignment between Northern Ireland and Great Britain on the one hand and Ireland on the EU on the other, Northern Ireland would use its devolved powers to create essentially an all-Ireland agricultural economy, which deals with, obviously, the biggest issue in terms of that border is SPS checks, so phytosanitary checks, right? And I think the point there is, this is a big role for Stormont in the backstop, is one of the kind of keys to unlocking this, because that can make things acceptable for DUP, and that then changes the parliamentary arithmetic, because I think a backstop that is controlled in Belfast, not Brussels, it is, I think, a perfectly tolerable solution. You know, if it is the Northern Ireland Assembly, which is obviously a slight problem here, not up and running, but if it's the Northern Ireland Assembly that is deciding where the friction is. That, I think, is much more acceptable than the current arrangement. You know, and I think you could also argue more in keeping with the spirit of a Good Friday Agreement than the current proposals. Yeah, way more in keeping with the Good Friday Agreement.
This is why I'm becoming more optimistic about there being a deal, some compromise in the backstop. All it takes is for somebody to talk Varadkar down off the ledge.
But it's also the Irish voters, isn't it? It's the Irish voters who are egging on Varadkar, who are... I mean, James, you quoted a really great figure the other day.
Was eight out of ten of them support Varadkar's position.
Right, exactly.
But what we've had in recent weeks is the Irish finance minister and others spell out what no deal would mean, and there is no way.
But as we know, the establishment doesn't necessarily persuade the electorate along.
Right, but this is why James and I are off quoting the Irish Times, because we think that common sense is biting on our Irish friends, if not on the Irish Taoiseach.
Although I would inject one note of caution. A friend of mine who is normally a perennial optimist, you know, you with sources, you basically work out whether you should steer off for optimism or pessimism. He went to the Doyle, the Irish Parliament recently. He said what was very depressing to him was everyone under the age of 54 there is up for a completely hard line, no compromise position. It's only those people who are in their late 50s and older who remember the delicacy of the Good Friday negotiations, etc., who are inclined for some kind of compromise. And I think if you look at the political dynamics here, obviously you can argue that no deal is a problem, but the kind of question is, you know, Leo Varadkar, how does he pull himself back in? And I mean, this is the kind of question, which is, how do you get it? I mean, this is the problem. This deal, this change to the backstop needs to be acceptable to multiple audiences. So how do you get something that Leo Varadkar can sell in Ireland, that Arlene Foster and the DUP can sell in Northern Ireland and sell to their community, and that Boris Johnson can sell in the House of Commons?
Yeah.
And, you know, finding something that fits all three of those things is, I think, very hard, unless, on the kind of Pat Leahy view, you're essentially prepared to fudge and basically come back to the issue in a few years' time. And that, I think, is the massive question that we are facing here. And there are various people on the Irish side who also think that no deal would be a temporary state. And this is one of the other big questions, right, which is lots of people on the EU side of this debate believe that no deal would last for a few months and then, you know, Britain would sober up and call and say, right, we're going to send you £39 billion in the post tomorrow. We're going to sign up to the backstop. Can we now have a negotiation about everything else? You know, and I think, I personally think that is possibly a very flawed analysis, because I think in terms of public opinion, if no deal Brexit was not a, you know, if you didn't end up with, you know, bare shelves in the supermarkets, if there was sufficient food, to use a phrase, you know, if the medicines got through, then I think you might find people saying, well, sod it, why should we, you know, the EU's attitude to us has been such that we don't want to go back to that table. But I think as long as the Irish think that no deal would be a purely temporary transitory phase, kind of over by Christmas, then I think they will be inclined to stick to their hardline position.
My biggest concern about no deal is, as you say, James, that people think it'd be temporary, but it wouldn't be. It would not just put the British in the kind of blitz spirits, thinking, right, we can get this, we're not going to come crawling back, but the EU as well. It would fracture diplomatic unity. It would create bad blood. My concern about no deal isn't really in the practical considerations. I think all of these concerns are hysterically overblown. I do worry more than most other people about what it would mean for the future of Anglo-Irish relations, Anglo-French relations, and indeed European relations in general. And I just do not think that the bad blood is worth it simply for the EU and primarily the Irish to refuse to grant the common sense compromise of on the backstop. After that, we could all move forward.
But what does worry me is that a few months ago, there was a view among some Irish officials that the backstop in seeking to take Northern Ireland out of the customs territory of the UK had gone a bit far. There was a kind of recognition that maybe asking for regulatory checks was one thing, but this different customs territory was perhaps a step too far. What worries me is that now those same people appear to be digging in on the idea that the backstop as currently defined is inviolable and cannot be touched. And I think that is a problem, which is that doesn't feel, you know, although one can see where the compromise would be, it doesn't fill you with hope that there is going to be a compromise. Mm. If people are now defending things that they themselves were admitting a few months ago had maybe gone a little far.
And in case this sounds a bit too much like a commercial for the Irish Times, there are excellent pieces by Dan O'Brien and Owen Harris and the Irish Independent as well on this as signs of where Irish opinion is shifting.
Thanks, Fraser. Thanks, James. If you enjoy this podcast, do subscribe, rate and review in all the usual routes. And why not try out some of our other podcasts? Some of them are political and some of them aren't. Just go to Spectator Radio, wherever you get your podcast from. And we have a special offer for subscribers this time. If you're a subscriber, you can get early bird ticket at a discounted rate to Douglas Murray in conversation with Lionel Shriver. They'll be talking about identity politics on the 28th of October in Westminster. To get tickets, go to spectator.co.uk/Lionel. Thanks for listening and do join us again tomorrow.